Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why a proposal to offer a tax credit to kidney donors may lead to ethical problems.
And we head down ballot and find out why the Central Arizona Water Conservation District election should matter to us all.
But first, autonomous trucks appear headed to the Valley. Pittsburgh-based Aurora Innovation says it's planning to expand its Fort Worth to El Paso route into Phoenix next year. The Valley is, of course, home to lots of autonomous vehicles from companies like Waymo and Cruise. People have been able to use the former as a taxi service for some time now. With me to talk about this new driverless venture into the region is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
So what is the significance of autonomous trucks now coming to the Valley? As I mentioned, we've had autonomous cars for quite a while.
Yeah, it's a big move by this company, Aurora, to expand into Arizona. Currently, they're testing their trucks pretty much only in Texas, I believe. And so they see Arizona as sort of another market in which they could potentially find new customers, find a lot more revenue. This is a company that is not bringing in a lot of revenue still because they are still sort of in a testing phase, but they're hoping to enter into more of a commercial phase later this year. And they have said that Arizona and Phoenix in particular is going to be sort of key to that starting next year.
Are these trucks mainly on highways? Or are they on surface streets as well?
Yeah, so I believe that Aurora only operates its trucks on highways right now. I think it's key to point out that they have yet to pull their safety drivers out of the trucks. They have said that they plan on doing that later this year, and that they won't be doing that until the end of next year, specifically for the Fort Worth to Phoenix route. They're going extremely cautiously. They have not quite achieved the same level of technological success as, like, for example, Waymo has with its robo-taxis in Phoenix. But they do have expressed a lot of confidence that they're going to be eventually testing their driverless, fully driverless trucks, but exclusively on highways starting at the end of next year in Phoenix.
What are the technological challenges in trying to build a truck that is autonomous relative to like the Waymo or the Cruise cars we see around the Valley?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. There's both challenges, but there's also some advantages as well. The challenge is obviously you have a much bigger vehicle, so there is something more of a safety risk involved with letting several tons of a truck go autonomous as opposed to a minivan or a crossover SUV. There needs to be a lot more concern over things like braking and stopping power. But that said, there's a lot about the sort of the operational domain that trucks operate in that makes them a little bit more have a more of an advantage over surface streets, residential areas, and sort of more of an urban setting. And that is, you have long stretches of just highway without any intersections or cross traffic. There aren't any traffic signals. There's no stop signs. For the most part, it's a very much more simplified operational domain than it is for robo-taxis. But that said, there still are a lot of safety concerns around this. And that's why I think you've seen companies like Aurora going about it a lot more conservatively. One could argue even more slowly than maybe a lot of experts might have originally predicted.
Right. Well, I would imagine also there's a difference between, for example, driving I-10 from El Paso to Tucson, where there's a lot of nothing in between, where as opposed to, for example, I-10 in Phoenix, where you have a lot of traffic and a lot of stop and start, and it's more of an urban environment.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that Aurora is definitely aware of some of those challenges on their own. So I do think that they need to demonstrate that these trucks can operate sort of whether or not it's in a setting like you described, where there are a lot of commuters, say, or business travelers, people that are using the highways as opposed to long stretches in which there are less there's much less traffic. So I think Aurora needs to demonstrate that its trucks can operate safely in both of those settings before they can successfully take their safety drivers out of the vehicle and start to operate fully driverlessly.
Has Aurora said why they're expanding their testing to Phoenix? Is it a matter of we have autonomous technology here, so why not add one more?
I do think that it has something to do with it, right? That Arizona has demonstrated itself as a friendly place for driverless testing, for driverless technology. That said, it's also, I think a lot of the conditions are pretty good for a company like Aurora. They're flat, it's dry conditions. There's not a lot of variations in the weather, for example. So I do think that those types of places are good for testing autonomous technology, at least on the early days. But, you know, for a company like this and others, they need to demonstrate that they can operate in a variety of different settings, regardless of the weather. But I do think that that's why you see so many companies looking to Arizona and the Southwest in particular, because of these sort of favorable conditions and these sort of early days of testing this type of technology.
Within the industry, what is the sense of the potential of autonomous trucking? I mean, we know, for example, that the trucking industry has been short of drivers for a while, and it's very challenging and in some cases kind of boring work to do. What is the potential of having trucks that can essentially drive themselves in terms of getting stuff from point A to point B?
Yeah, I think the driver shortage issue is definitely something that a lot of the companies have been cited as one of the potential advantages of having autonomous trucks. There's so much commerce that goes on in this country, especially with e-commerce now, especially that there's been a huge spike in the amount of goods and things and packages that are being shipped across the country. And the companies, the carriers themselves have been struggling to find enough drivers to do this work. It's long, it's tedious. Takes you away from your family for a long time. And often it doesn't pay the greatest. So I think that that's definitely one of the things. But then also there's the safety case that a lot of these companies make. You know, there were thousands of people that have died in accidents and crashes involving large trucks in the past years. I think in the last one that I've seen, I think it was 2022, where there was at least 6,000 people that died in these crashes involving heavy trucks. And so the autonomous companies will say, well, you know, our trucks never get tired. They never get sleepy. They never fall asleep at the wheel. They never make mistakes. So that's something where they could potentially see some benefits as well.
Interesting. All right. That is Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor at The Verge. Andrew, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, always. Thanks so much.
A bill in Congress would create a pilot project allowing for people who donate kidneys to an anonymous recipient on the National Kidney Waitlist to get a $50,000 tax credit spread over 5 years. The National Kidney Foundation reports more than 100,000 Americans need a kidney transplant. Around 17,000 get one each year. This proposal aims to increase that last number. A paper published in 2019 tried to estimate the financial disincentives to becoming a kidney donor when taking into account factors like loss of income while recovering, decrease in long-term quality of life, the pain and discomfort of removing the kidney itself, and the worry that a close friend or family member may need a kidney down the road. The authors put the financial disincentive at nearly $38,000. They also concluded that if the government removed all disincentives, kidney donations would increase by 60% per year. But offering money to potential organ donors raises a host of questions and problems, according to my next guest. Dr. David Beda is chair and professor in the Department of Bioethics and Medical Humanism at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix. He joins me to talk more about this. And Dr. Beda, first off, just what do you make of this proposal?
There are some significant ethical issues here. And, you know, there's positives and negatives. The main issue is, how do we go about making sure that this truly is an altruistic donation of a kidney without marginalizing those who are not able to kind of contribute to something like this? You know, there's a lot of danger in giving $50,000 to someone who's already marginalized and they are coerced because of the amount of money that they can receive rather than being truly altruistic. So there's some issues here.
It sounds like you're worried about people maybe being targeted and saying, hey, look, you've got two kidneys. You only really need one. Here's $50,000 if you're willing to do it. And they're maybe not so on board, but they need the money, so they do it.
Absolutely. That's the biggest issue that I think many of us in the ethics arena are really concerned about.
Do you see a problem with, for people who might be inclined to offer a kidney, to give them an incentive to do it? Even if it's not, you know, their decision is not entirely altruistic, maybe it's, you know, 50% altruistic, but, you know, the money certainly also doesn't hurt?
No, I don't think there's an issue with that, but we have to make certain that those who engage in receiving money for their kidneys, and they're not being coerced and they're not marginalized, that they in turn need to have some rigorous protections, specifically a very detailed informed consent and long-term health monitoring, because they only will now have one kidney. So, you know, it's just not taking their kidney and then saying, thank you, here's $50,000, and watching them walk away. We have to be truly engaged in following up with them to make sure that, let's say their second kidney, their remaining kidney starts to fail. Who's responsible for maintaining their health at that point?
Well, it sounds like from a societal standpoint, it could also mean that this is more than a $50,000 per person endeavor, right? Like if that donor needs some kind of health care down the road, you're saying that it should be not just on them to pay for that.
I agree. I think if we're going to be engaged in going in this direction, we have to protect the donor, and we also have to protect the recipient. And that means having ongoing healthcare monitoring for both of them to make sure that everything is in place.
Is there a way to try to reduce the danger of coercion, as you're describing? Like, is informed consent, for example, is that enough? Can there be enough to make sure that, to the extent possible, that sort of thing doesn't happen?
You know, this whole concept of informed consent is an ethical dilemma in and of itself. There's many who believe that informed consent, as it is portrayed today, doesn't exist. And let me be frank, because this is kind of where I see it. And as a physician, I've seen this happen. Informed consent is usually garnered when the information is given in order to receive the answer that the physician wants. You know, it's almost like a coercion. I'm being a little facetious at this point. I'm probably going to get a lot of pushback on this. But think about it. If I, as a physician, want to do a particular procedure or start a therapy, I'm going to give just enough information to get the answer I want, which is I agree. The patient's going to say, I agree. Where we really have to have a detailed informed consent process where we examine everything. And to be frank, physicians, we don't know everything. And so how can you truly have an informed consent?
So if this proposal of offering this tax credit is problematic, are there other ways to try to increase the number of kidney donors? Because obviously there's a pretty long list of patients who need them, and you know, people are not able to get them, and they're not able to continue living. So is there a better way in your mind to get more people to donate, so more people on the transplant list can get transplants?
Well, I don't think there's essentially a better way, because all the different ways that are currently being offered carry with them ethical issues. But one of the ways that we do know is, for example, retrieving organs from a patient who is brain dead. But there's another format that is being done, and that's donation after cardiac death.
But if that's already being done and we still have this long list of patients who need kidneys, is that enough? Like, are there more steps that maybe need to be taken?
Yeah, I think everyone's looking at that. What are the steps? And it comes down to making sure we ask the right ethical questions before we engage in the next steps. So that's being explored. And I think that where we're at right now is making sure that we don't engage in coercive behavior, trying to get more kidneys, that we don't engage in a lackadaisical approach to declaring someone dead. And so the long and short answer to your question is, you know, people are looking at it, but there really is no good answer at this point. People are struggling to try and find a way to increase the amount of organs for those who truly need them.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if there are other instances in the healthcare world where there are incentives to do something, maybe not quite at the scale, for example, of donating a kidney. But, you know, I can imagine, you know, you get tickets to something for donating blood, or, you know, there's something else that needs to be done that there's an incentive offered for people to do them. Do you see that in the kind of work that you're doing?
You know, here's an example where there is no incentive. There is, for example, a huge list of individuals who altruistically volunteer to be bone marrow donors. And that's across the world. So people with different types of leukemia or anemia, I mean, cancer, who need a bone marrow transplant, their names are put into this list that's huge of individuals around the world who altruistically say, I will donate my my blood for bone marrow transplant or for blood transfusion, et cetera, for a patient with cancer. They're not paid for that. It's an altruistic approach. And, you know, that may be a better way to go for kidney donations, because that truly exemplifies altruism.
Is there a danger, do you think, that if, for example, this End Kidney Deaths Act were to go into effect, that people who might be otherwise inclined to donate bone marrow, donate other organs, you know, in the name of helping people, in the name of altruism, might look at this and say, well, wait a minute, why are kidney donors getting a $50,000 tax credit and I'm getting nothing?
Well, welcome to the world of ethics. So that's the big issue. Once you start something on one end, you better be prepared for what's going to happen down the line. So absolutely, that can certainly happen.
All right. That is Dr. David Beda, chair and professor in the Department of Bioethics and Medical Humanism at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix. Dr. Beda, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, online fashion trends come and go quickly, but one in particular hit a nerve for one Southwest stylist.
But first,
Election 2024 is getting nearer, and while all of the talk might seem to be about the top of the ticket, there are down-ballot races that will be incredibly influential in all of our lives here in Arizona. And this morning, we're going to talk about one of them, the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. Never heard of it? You're probably not alone. There are 5 seats open on the Little Known Board this November, which is charged with overseeing the Central Arizona Project, that 336-mile canal that brings the Colorado River water to all of us here in the Valley, as well as in Pinal County and Tucson. Here to explain it all, including why it matters so much, is Joanna Allhands, who covers water issues on the opinion pages of the Arizona Republic. Good morning, Joanna.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so begin for us with just a little bit about what this conservation district does. What does it mean that it oversees the CAP canals?
Sure. So they are really charged with making sure that the water goes from where we get it out of the Colorado River all the way down that 336-mile stretch to the cities and the tribes that rely on this water. So they are responsible for maintenance. They're responsible for, you know, charging for the fees, all the things that you have to do to get water to a city for processing and to your tap.
Okay. So there are 5 seats up for grabs, as I mentioned, but there are 15 members of the board. It's a pretty big board.
And it is a big board.
Right. It's one we can actually vote for the members of. How many candidates are there trying to fill these 5 seats?
So there's 6 candidates for 5 seats, which actually is less than we've had in previous elections. In some, actually the last 2 elections, we've had more than a dozen candidates vying for seats. So This is actually relatively less than we've had.
Okay. So I want to get to the candidates and kind of the stakes in the race in a moment, but I want to talk first about the broader picture here, because this comes at a time when we're talking about Colorado River water a lot. Like, we know that the Colorado River is under threat, like it's shrinking, it's over allocated, but we haven't heard a ton about it of late because we had a pretty good winter last time around, right? So tell us where this all stands right now.
Right. Well, yeah. And you haven't seen the horrible, you know, oh my goodness, Lake Mead is running out of water stories, because in addition to the fact that we had a wet winter a couple of winters ago, there are billions of dollars of federal money right now that are helping to pay people to temporarily not use water, which has really helped prop up Lake Mead and has kept it stable. It's not going back down like it historically has. So that's why we're in better shape right now. But The rules that operate Lake Mead and Lake Powell are going to be expiring in 2026. And so basically all of the things that we've been doing for the last 20 years, we're kind of at a point where you can hit reset and say, like, okay, so, but what are we going to do now for the next 20, maybe 30, who knows, you know, ever long past now. And so it really is kind of a turning point where we're at of trying to figure out how do we really stabilize the lakes? Because we tried to do that with the rules that we have now and it didn't work. So we're trying to figure out how do we make that work now?
So it's going to be probably deeper cuts in the long term.
Most probably.
Right. So the Conservation District Board we're talking about here is not going to make those big picture decisions about the Colorado River and the future there. What is their connection and their stake in this?
Well, so, right, they're not going to be the ones who, you know, necessarily are signing on the dotted line. You know, the state negotiators, CAP is actually involved in that process, but they're not necessarily like the end all be all final, you know, voice in it.
Mm-hmm.
What is at stake for them is that just because of how the water was prioritized, the different, you know, seniority of water rights that we have around the Colorado River, CAP is the least senior. And so, you know, historically, when we've had to have cuts, guess who's first in line for those? Mm. It's typically been the Central Arizona Project. So if we are expecting probably deeper and potentially permanent cuts to the amount of water that we get from the Colorado River, it could fall more heavily on CAP, or it may not. I mean, right now, that's the big discussion is, how do we figure out how we're going to do this in the future and who's going to have to basically pay, quote unquote, to level out the lake?
Okay. So if we're looking at big cuts for the CAP and less water in those canals that we all know that flow into the city here, this board will be the ones who have to decide what to do with it and who gets less water, essentially.
Right, right.
Talk a little bit about the candidates here. I can't imagine on a 15-member board that a lot of folks have never heard of. We know a lot of them, but tell us about who they might be and if we've heard of some of them before.
Right. So of the six candidates that we have, there are four incumbents who are running again. And it's true, probably they're not household names. One of them, actually, though, if you've been around politics for a while, you may know, would be Terry Goddard, who is a former mayor of Phoenix and former attorney general for the state. So, you know, one of the challengers that is not an incumbent, but who is running is Brian Biesmeyer, who is the head of the Scottsdale City Water Department. So there are people who are involved, longtime involved people. Lisa Atkins is another one of the incumbents. She's been on the board for a very long time. So there's people who have been in water and around water for a really long time who are running for these seats this time.
Makes sense. So as a voter, right, this is an interesting race because it's only six candidates for five seats, as we said, but also because it's not broken down by party lines in any kind of clear way that would make it easy for voters to decide who to vote for. You're hosting a debate with the candidates for these spots coming up here. Talk a little bit about how folks should think about this and decide who to vote for.
Right. Well, in this, this is a nonpartisan race. So I know in our politics today, we tend to really think about like, okay, well, are you on the left or the right?
Right.
And really, that's always sort of been the way with water. And thank goodness it's been that way with water, where it's not necessarily cleanly broken down on partisan lines. So, you know, things that are important to think about in this race are just, where do you see the CAP in the future? You know, what their plans are, listening to them about like, how they would deal with some of the challenges that are happening on the river. It's more policy driven. This is really much more of a board where if you're going to suss out differences between candidates, it's really going to be in the policy, not necessarily like, are you pro-life or, you know, pro-choice?
Right. Lots to think about. Thanks for joining us. That is Joanna Allhands, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Joanna, appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. It's likely to be a busy week in Iran. Its new president is expected to give his first press conference in the coming days. At the same time, the country is accused of sending ballistic missiles to Russia, and UN weapons inspectors are meeting to talk about Iran's nuclear capabilities. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, lots going on in Iran right now.
That's right. And a lot of people associate Iran, of course, particularly in recent weeks, with its links with Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthi rebels, the rebel group in Yemen. And so Iran is very rarely out of the headlines in some way or other. But in recent weeks, there have been accusations that Iran has been selling ballistic missiles to Russia to use in Ukraine. And that's interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is that it's turbocharged the debate in Western countries about whether Ukraine should be allowed to use Western missiles, long-range missiles, to target sites in Russia itself, on the territory of Russia itself, which has been a hot debate and has divided the so-called allies. So that's an interesting discussion. And at the same time, we have sanctions. Various Western countries have tightened their sanctions on Iran because of this allegation. And by the way, Iran denies that it's actually done this or that it's in the process of doing this. So that's one sort of facet of what's going on. We've also got the international inspectors who want to get back into Iran to test for uranium enrichment, which they allege is going on. They say there are traces of uranium in various places in Iran. They want to get in there and have another look at that. And then sort of to add an extra string, your listeners might remember that the president of Iran, Raisi, was killed in that helicopter crash back in May when the helicopter crashed into a a foggy mountain. And that brought elections to Iran over the summer. And that brought a new president to Iran. And he really is very new to a lot of people. He's actually a heart surgeon. He's a reformer, so they say, and he wants to reduce the sanctions on his country from Western countries. So we are wondering now if he's going to hold a press conference, which we're expecting this week, what will he say?
Interesting. Okay, Rob, let's go now to India, where two big cases will be heard this week by India's Supreme Court, each which could say something significant about the state of the world's largest democracy. What's going on there?
Well, that's right. So in India, as you say, the world's largest democracy, but it's also a majority Hindu nation and, of course, has loads and loads of minorities, but one of which is the Muslim population, which is very big in India. And for many, many years, there's been this real tension between the Hindus and the Muslims. There's all kinds of incidents over the years between those two communities. Nowadays, what you see is when there are Hindu protests about something alleged to have been done by the Muslim community, you see protesters carrying these little bulldozers, these little yellow toy bulldozers, bizarrely, in their hands when they're taking part in demonstrations. The reason they're doing that is because a tactic has developed over time whereby if a Muslim activist, for example, is considered to have done something wrong, they may suddenly find that their home has been bulldozed by the authorities. It's called bulldozer justice. And the Supreme Court of India is looking into that this week to really check to see its legality or otherwise. So that's an interesting case. Another one, briefly, is the rape and murder of a young woman in a public hospital in the city of Kolkata a little while ago. And that brought people out in protest all over the country because of the issue of the safety of women, the protection and security of women, because that's a big issue in India, violence against women that goes relatively unchallenged and unpunished, and particularly of women working in public institutions like hospitals. And this was a perfect example. So the Supreme Court of India is going to be busy on those two cases this week.
Indeed. Okay, Rob, just south of India now, the island of Sri Lanka will go to the polls this coming week. Why is this election so significant?
Well, that's right. So if you go south of India, you come to the teardrop. It really does look like a teardrop, that little island just off India, which in the past has been and now is well known for the number of tourists that go there. This is how Sri Lanka has made much of its foreign currency over the years. The problem is that over the last few years, things have gone wrong there in terms of the economy. That was partly because of COVID, because it meant, of course, the tourists didn't come. So the foreign currency reserves in Sri Lanka basically dried up. That was also affected by bomb attacks, serious bomb attacks, in which I think 300 people plus were killed in Sri Lanka in 2019. So it meant that lots of tourists stayed away. That, combined with rather questionable economic policies, shall we say, led Sri Lanka down a difficult road. Its economy essentially collapsed. Its inflation shot up, its energy costs shot up. That brought people out onto the streets to protest. So it's been a very turbulent time in Sri Lanka's recent history. And that's why the elections this coming Saturday, we're watching them carefully to see if, frankly, if Sri Lanka can get back on the rails again.
Okay, so Rob, this is radio, of course, but there will be a pretty significant visual story this coming week in which hundreds of paratroopers will be landing around a city in Holland. What's going on with that?
This is a great story, really. You're right. Totally visual, and is bound to be all over our television screens later this week. And that is that 80 years ago this week, 1,900 paratroopers, Allied paratroopers, jumped out of aircraft over Arnhem, a city on the eastern flank of the Netherlands, where it borders Germany, and their mission was to try and capture the bridges over the Rhine at Arnhem in order from the Germans, in order for the Allies to have an opening, if you like, into Germany to create a front against the Germans, which was considered extremely important there. Now, that was 80 years ago this week. It was an extraordinary event. There was even a film back in the 1970s called A Bridge Too Far, which was made about this. It didn't go quite to plan, and it's an extraordinary story. But anyway, it's being marked this week, the 80th anniversary, by some 700 paratroopers, the modern equivalent of the people that jumped then. They'll be jumping this week. And if the weather's half decent, we're going to see TV pictures of 700 paratroopers jumping out of military aircraft over the Netherlands. It should be quite a sight.
All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
And you too, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Journalist Richard Grant has a fascination with transience. Over the course of his long career as a travel writer, he's explored parts of the world that seem to attract people in transition, including the Mississippi Delta, East Africa, and now Arizona. In his new book, A Race to the Bottom of Crazy, Grant turns the camera on himself, documenting his recent return to Tucson, where he first lived when he was in his 20s. The book chronicles his transformation from a rebellious young writer into a doting father and his rediscovery of the state where he found his voice as a writer. Along the way, he profiles a rogues gallery of infamous Arizonans, some of whom, as Grant recently told the show's Sam Dingman, weren't cut out for life in the desert.
David Grundman was... I think he'd done some time in jail. He was a drug dealer who had ripped off his own customers back in, I think, New York State. And then he drifted out to Phoenix. He was working in a restaurant. And he, one day with his friend, packed a shotgun and some shells, and they drove out into the desert. And he blasted away at this saguaro cactus. And one large limb of the saguaro cactus detached from the gunfire and simultaneously impaled and crushed him to death. He's sort of Arizona anti-hero.
Yeah, there's a few of those in the book. But if I may, we see this dynamic of how capable one is of existing in one's surroundings echoed throughout the book. And there's a sequence that I really loved where you go off on a reporting trip to the Sierra Madre Mountains. And when you get there, you encounter this culture of lawlessness that seems to really test the limits of what you feel like you can handle.
Yeah, well, I definitely found my limits in the Sierra Madre. So the Sierra Madre is kind of like this Wild West that exists on Arizona's back doorstep. And it begins just south of the border. You can drive down to Douglas. You can see the mountains there. And it's one of the biggest production areas in the world for heroin. And when I was there, they were flying in tons of coke from Colombia into these little airstrips. And it had a phenomenally high murder rate. People say it was about drugs, but a lot of it was about sort of wounded masculine pride. People were getting killed for refusing to have drinks with other men. And after a couple of months, I was hunted through the woods at night by these two kind of Mexican hillbillies and was very, very lucky to get out of there. I was running from trucks through the woods and running across a river from these guys who appeared like they wanted to kill me.
Yeah. I mean, that's not the only run-in that you have with outlaws and kind of outlaw culture in this book. And it seems to me that one of the things you're writing about is not just yourself, but also why Arizona is such a haven for both of those things, outlaws and outlaw culture. What do you think it is about our state that makes that shoe or perhaps cowboy boot fit so well?
Well, I mean, it was sort of there in the history, but it's also there in the mythology that Arizona in particular is mythologized kind of rugged individualism, like no one tells me what to do. And I remember I was living off the grid down near the border near a place called Aravaca, and the county wanted to put in a sheriff's substation, and the town, almost to a man and woman, rose up and opposed the idea of having law in their community, even though they were a kind of disparate bunch of artists and cowboys and drug smugglers and vegetarians with AK-47s, but all of them were united in this belief that they didn't want a sheriff's substation. I remember one guy got up in the meeting and said, "A man can only stand so much law."
I'm really glad you brought up Aravaca, because the Aravaca sequence is fantastic. And one of the things it made me wonder is how much, when you were living in places like this, even though you were there to report on lawlessness or sometimes just to be adjacent to it while you were writing other things, if you ever thought of yourself as a kind of outlaw.
I wanted to live with as little policing around me as possible and as much personal freedom as I could find. That was very important to me when I was younger, and that's one of the reasons why I went to live in Aravaca. It wasn't really to write about the place, it was to live there. Kind of on the margins of society. That appealed to me very much at that stage of my life. And I was very happy there, living off the grid on this ranch 8 miles from Aravaca. Couldn't see another light at night.
Yeah. There's a really moving sequence in the book where you go back there many years later, and it's gotten much more lawful than it was when you were there. And you seem quite crestfallen at that development.
I shouldn't be, but I just had such vivid memories, especially this one bar, the La Gitana. I mean, the kind of classic La Gitana story, there's this guy named Chance that I used to be friends with, and he went in there with this long duster coat with a sawn-off shotgun in the inside pocket, and he flung open his coat, and the shotgun jumped out and landed butt first on the floor of the bar and discharged into his armpit. And then this tattooed arm like fell on the floor, and you could always see the bloodstain of that arm on the floor. And there was a biker named Mugger who would pull out people's teeth on the pool table with a pair of pliers. It was that kind of bar. But when I went back, it had all been cleaned up, and there was families eating there. And it was just a real shock more than anything. I was just so shocked.
Yeah. Well, speaking of outlaws, there's one in particular who plays the role, I think, in the book of sort of like the patron saint. And I'm thinking here of Chuck Boden.
I think he's the most interesting writer that Arizona has. I mean, he was originally from Chicago, but he basically came to Arizona, I think, as a teenager. And just unlike anybody else that I've ever met, he was cranky. He was brilliant. He was like enormously well-read, enormously intelligent, erratic. He lived in squalor. One of those people that never went into mass production. I'd never met anybody else like him.
Yeah.
And he just helped me out a lot when I was starting out as a writer, and I will be eternally grateful for that.
It's clear, you know, from the book how influential he was to you in terms of the types of stories that he pursued, and it seems like that influenced the types of stories that you wanted to pursue. And he says at one point, you know, you ask him why he wants to go cover this really horrific cartel violence because it's so dangerous. And he says, well, like, I'm a reporter. It's my job not to turn away. And there's a lot of quotes and anecdotes from him like that in the book. But my favorite is, quote, "It's going to be a bloody mess, but we have to believe in the future. Every bird on earth is going to mate and build a nest next spring."
Yeah, that's just Chuck all over the place, because he had this very dystopian vision of the future, it was basically going to be a clash between limited resources and unlimited human appetites. And this was going to reach a kind of violent inflection point. But it didn't make him pessimistic or depressed. He just had such a love of life and the world. Mm-hmm. He really disapproved of people that just gave up and didn't fight for the future and didn't believe in the future.
Yeah. You know, speaking of all these aphorisms and quotes that Chuck bestowed upon you throughout your life, you say that Chuck is the person who convinced you that writing matters. Why does it matter to you?
I think if you've got any talent for it, especially nonfiction writing, that it's incumbent upon you to just try your hardest to describe the way things are, partly just to record how they are, partly maybe, hopefully, to help other people understand things a little more deeply. I feel like I've got just enough talent that I ought to put in the work. I guess that's what Chuck persuaded me of, and that it does matter in some small way.
Yeah. Well, Richard Grant is the author of the book A Race to the Bottom of Crazy, Dispatches from Arizona. Richard, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Fashion trends come and go on social media these days faster than you can restock your wardrobe. Last summer, it was all about Barbie core. There was also mermaid core, and who can forget coastal cowgirl. But this summer, a new TikTok fashion trend has entered the picture, and it's one we can't help but weigh in on because it's called Chic Desert Ant. The Chic Desert Ant was coined by stylist Alison Bornstein, and it's inspired by your slightly kooky aunt who wears suede, earth tones, natural fabrics, and statement accessories. Here's a clip of her description of it on TikTok.
The thing about the Chic Desert Ant is that she has very elevated and timeless pieces, but she's also super fun, and she, like, she wants to add a little spice to things, you know? She's going to put on like a very chic kind of linen blouse, but she's going to add an amazing necklace that her friend in Arizona made her.
Laurel Kinney is a personal stylist who splits her time between Austin, Texas and Taos, New Mexico. And she told me this particular trend struck a chord with her.
So to me, I felt deeply connected to this trend, and I don't usually ever, but I was like, wait, that actually describes me. So she's someone that is more into living her life on her terms and being independent and kind of responsible for a lot, but she's also like living kind of outside of sort of conventionality. And she loves to feel a part of her environment, like mm-hmm. nature is very important to her. So a lot of the aesthetic is kind of this natural vibe of earth tones and like natural fabrics. And maybe it's more about the color and the texture more than the print or like the pieces themselves being really eye-catching. It's more of just this overall aesthetic of comfort, functionality, and connection to nature. Yeah. And then it's kind of punctuated with accessories. And I think the accessories are the thing that kind of sets it apart from just like Eileen Fisher kind of vibe.
I thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the accessories are sort of often, it seems like a mark of her travels, or like, I think in the original TikTok describing this, like she talks about a necklace made by your friend in Arizona, like that kind of thing, right?
Totally. It's more like a personal connection to the way you're presenting yourself. It's like you're telling a story with your accessories, and it's sort of like, this is also a souvenir, and it also serves as like a shovel or something. It could be multi-purpose.
Okay. So this you felt very connected to. You kind of split your time between Austin, Texas and Taos, New Mexico, sort of classic stomping grounds of the Sheikh Desert yeah. Ant, it sounds like, right?
Yes, and I actually moved to Taos to be with my nephews.
That's awesome. Okay. It's definitely something you relate to. Do you see yes. this around? Do you see a lot of people kind of adopting this vibe, this style, this particular look? And have they been doing it for a long time?
Yeah, I don't see it as a new adoption. It's more like this is a description of something that has been existing. Mm-hmm. And it's just like putting language to it, which I find very satisfying. And I do think that in my mind, I'm like, oh, well, that's like every girl in Santa Fe.
Right. You know? Absolutely.
She's an artist, but she also can like build her own patio.
Right. Okay. I like that. I like that. So I wonder, though, because this does seem to be hitting on a nerve, not just in the Southwest, but something that's been going on kind of around the country and maybe mm-hmm. internationally even right now, from what I can tell, like the desert's having a bit of a moment. What do you think is so attractive about the desert right now, like in our psyche?
I think it's this romantic feeling that you get from expansiveness. To me, the desert is so inspiring because it is like the one place where you can go that you are the only one there. And it feels very like open. You can see for my, like, I love that feeling of just being on top of a mesa and like seeing nothing around you, but like this flat, beautiful space and maybe a mountain or two and like the sky. Mm-hmm. You can just feel this open possibility feeling. And I just also think the colors are so calming and soothing, and it's sort of this like opposite feeling that you get from the modern way of living where everything is so like congested and closed in and you're looking at a tiny screen all the time. Instead, you're thinking about the sky and the desert and the clouds.
So there are a lot of these kind of coined internet style trends that seem to be going around these days. Mm-hmm. Like last summer, it was Barbiecore. Like, do you remember right. Coastal Cowgirl? That was a big one, right?
Totally. Yes.
Do you appreciate trends like these, or do you think this is fluff and like you should just look at fashion in a more individualistic sense?
I think sustainability is super important, and that's kind of a pillar of my work. I try to only give recommendations for ethically made and sustainably made clothes if I can. So I think these micro trends end up being a little wasteful in that, like, if you're really trying to like be a different vibe all the time, you end up having a lot of clothes. And it's like excessive. So what I really loved about the Sheikh Desert Ant is that she is not living near a lot of stores, so she's literally not shopping very much, and so she's wearing things that are more long-lasting and more timeless and mm-hmm. Being more thoughtful and intentional about it, which I think that is kind of a pervasive theme that is coexisting as these micro trends have also started to pop up.
And it's like an inspiration sort of in a way, like this might give you an idea or a direction to look at when you're trying to explore style, right?
Yeah, and like a way to communicate about it, or this sort of freedom to like wear things that aren't just the way they show you in the store.
Laurel, do you have any predictions of what trend might come next?
Oh, for a long time I was like, oh, everything's getting bigger and flowier and like the baggier, the better. And mm-hmm. now I'm like, well, I feel like people are missing their waist a little bit. And so things might become a little more structured, but it always is like a new iteration. I just feel like I can see carved out waists. Okay, that's so specific. I just feel like there's gonna be a peplum happening, but it's not gonna be the peplum we know.
Okay, all right. There's a trend that might have a coined term for it one day soon.
One day.
Here. All right. That is Laurel Kinney, a personal stylist, joining us to talk more about Sheikh Desert Ant. Laurel, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for talking
to me
about this. I appreciate it.
Me too.
You know what you are, Mark Brody?
Oh, gosh.
Sheikh Desert radio host.
I mean, Some of those are true. Take out the sheik, and I think you got it.
All right. We'll take that.
All right. That'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.